We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about Chechnya. It's been estimated that since 1994, conflicts in Chechnya have resulted in the deaths of something between 65,000 and 75,000 civilians. Our guest for this hour of the show, Emma Gilligan, professor of Russian history at University of Connecticut, says that Chechnya is the site of one of the worst human rights catastrophes of the post-communist era. She also goes on to say that unlike the vast body of literature that has been devoted to Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, scholars have devoted relatively little attention to the abuses of human rights in Chechnya. In this hour of our show, we'll be talking about that. It's the subject of a book that she's authored. The title is Terror in Chechnya, Russia and the Tragedy of Civilians in War, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. It's a conflict, she says, that has yet to be fully acknowledged by the international community. A little bit more about our guest, Emma Gilligan. She's assistant professor of Russian history and human rights at the University of Connecticut, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. Now, as we talk, questions from people who are listening are welcome. We do ask that people try to be brief in their comments, so we can accommodate as many different callers as possible, but certainly calls are welcome. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. If it would be a long-distance call, we have a toll-free line for you to use, and that is 800-222-9455. And also, you may email us with your comments and questions. Again, it'll help us if you can keep it brief. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here you want to participate, you're certainly welcome to do that. Professor Gilligan, hello.
Yes, good morning, David.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
To start, I think maybe, forgive me if this is such a basic level, but I think that there will be a lot of people listening that don't have a lot of basic background about Chechnya, and probably the first thing we should do is just ask you to talk a little bit about where it is, and then just the briefest list of things that people really need to know just to start us out.
Okay, sure. Well, fundamentally, it's in a region called the Northern Caucasus, and this, to the south of Chechnya, is Georgia, the Republic of Georgia. To the north of it is the region of Stavropol and southern Russia. Buffeting it either side, to the west is the Republic of Ingushetia, and to its right is Dagestan. Now, it also sits somewhere between the Black and Caspian Seas, so that's fairly important geostrategically. It also, I guess, to get a sense of the dimensions of the place, it's about the size of Connecticut, and the population there has wavered, but fundamentally, it's about just over a million people now. So the history really, in terms of its relationship with Russia, does go back, as I'm sure many people are aware, to the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And that is fundamentally when Russia was concerned about extending its sphere of influence through Georgia, through to Turkey. So there had been a very difficult relationship where Russia had extended its sphere of influence down into Chechnya, into the Caucasian Mountains, and obviously there had been resistance by Dagestani leaders and Chechen leaders at that particular time. Now, that uneasy relationship continued on until the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. And fundamentally, it seemed at that time that because of the nationality policy of the Bolshevik government, it looked as though the Chechen people might actually achieve their independence. Unfortunately, that wasn't to happen. And so there had been skirmishes in the early part of the 20th century into the 1930s and particular into the 1940s. So the Germans actually reached Chechnya in the 1940s, and there was some support by the Germans for the Chechen resistance movement against the Russians. And fundamentally what happened as a result of that was the Stalin's regime used that so-called betrayal by the Chechen resistance, a very small part of the population, to deport the Chechen population from Chechnya in February 1944 to the Republic of Kazakhstan. Now, this particular deportation is well known, precisely because they moved the entire population out of the region, and they were removed in a very, very short period of time, within about 3 or 4 days. It was a KGB operation, NKVD operation that was organized from above, that was executed very diligently and very efficiently. Unfortunately, many thousands of Chechens died in the transportation to Kazakhstan, in the wagons that were used to transport them. And this, effectively, there were also cases of two particular massacres at this particular moment. One was in the mountain village of Haibach, in which 700 people were put inside a barn or a shed, and the barn and shed were set alight. This was predominantly done because the time in which the deportation took place was snowing very, very heavily, and so these people couldn't be moved out of the mountain region, so they were massacred in this particular way. Now, I think as people can imagine, the memory of this deportation looms large in the collective memory of Chechens, and they were finally allowed to return to Chechnya in 1956 under Khrushchev and under the period of the Thaw. And I guess that really from that time forward, it started a new relationship in a sense with the Russians, where many Chechens were assimilated. Russian was the main language that was taught. And social mobility, although difficult for Chechens in terms of getting into positions of power either in the government or the oil industry, did begin. And so there was some assimilation, really, I guess, until the era of perestroika, where the difficulties that define the last 15 years of their relationship with Russia actually began.
Mm-hmm. So there, to say the least, then, there was this long, uneasy relationship between the Chechens and the Russians. Many Chechens, I'm sure, were not happy about Russian rule. There was, for a long time, this... I'm sure many people who felt that Chechnya was and should be independent. And it seems that when you come to the point of the Soviet Union coming apart, that then I'm sure that many people who were involved in the Chechen independence movement felt that this was their moment.
I think so. That's right, David. And I think that some of the uneasiness extended from the fact of that many Chechens were Sunni Muslims, and that they had really been forced to practice their religion underground, as many had other denominations had been in the Soviet Union as well. And so there was a tension between, obviously, Orthodox Russians and Muslims living in Chechnya. Now, I think the Chechens, when Yeltsin said, you know, in the early 1990s, he said, look, take as much sovereignty as you can handle, right? This was the statement that he said. And clearly we are aware now that the Baltic states, the Ukraine, Georgia, I mean, that the disintegration of the Soviet Union was an opportunity for many Eastern European countries to seek the independence or reclaim independence that they'd had before. Now, if one is to see it within that historical framework, then you can understand that Chechens themselves saw this as an opportunity for them to go ahead and to claim the autonomy that perhaps not all, but I think many felt was due to them and that they wanted for themselves, mm-hmm. definitely.
The book concentrates on a period which is known as the Second Chechen War. This was a 10-year period that actually officially, I think, just ended last August.
That's right.
A period between 1999 and 2009. And we will talk about that. But first, maybe I should ask you to talk a little bit about the First Chechen War. In December of 1994, Russia sent troops into Chechnya. And this war lasted 2 years. It ultimately became very unpopular with the Russian people. And Boris Yeltsin, who was president at the time, really had to end it. He declared a ceasefire. He signed a peace treaty with the then Chechen president, Aslan Maschadov, who then was killed later. And I think in the book you make the argument that the Russians intentionally did that. They wanted him out of the way, in fact, because they didn't want to have somebody to talk with, and he would have been the one person that they could have worked with. Now, I've said too much there. Maybe the question is, well, why was it that in December of 1994 that the Russian government decided to send troops into Chechnya?
Yeah, I mean, there had been a great deal of it was a very unsettled environment in Chechnya between 1990 and 1994. There's absolutely no doubt about that. There was concern about those who were trying to lead the independence movement. There was a lot of tension between Chechens who were actually pro-Moscow supporters and wanted to remain at least part of the Russian Federation, at least perhaps a semi-autonomous unit within the Russian Federation. They felt fundamentally that for the future of the Chechen Republic, that it was a safer way to go in terms of alliances between, in terms of funding and budgetary concerns, that this was perhaps a more practical way for Chechnya to move ahead. Now, there were fundamentally others who felt that that they needed a decisive break, and that there was then, by 1993, 1994, a concern about a civil war breaking out inside Chechnya between these two different groups. This situation was, I think, dealt very poorly by Yeltsin and his presidential administration, fundamentally. They had largely ignored what was taking place there between the self-proclaimed president, President Dudayev, and they really had neglected to negotiate with Dudayev and the situation on the ground. What they decided to do instead was to send in troops in the summer of 1994. These troops were actually didn't do such a wonderful job of ameliorating the situation and were pushed back. So Yeltsin and his team decided by November that they needed to take more decisive action. Now, I think the political context is important to remember here. This is following the 1993 elections to the parliament, and these elections were predominantly won by Zhirinovsky and his team. The nationalist right was doing unexpectedly well in Russia at this particular time. So I think Yeltsin was certainly concerned about that, and I think perhaps he thought that dealing with Chechnya more decisively may play a positive role in bringing back some of these nationalist supporters to his own field or his own constituency. So they sent the troops in, and I think, as many people know, absolutely disastrously. The point was that not only was the bombing indiscriminate, but the actual ground troops that were sent in were totally unprepared for the situation that they encountered. And this was terrible for these young 18, 19-year-old young soldiers who'd been recruited from all around Russia, and many of these battalions had never trained together. So fundamentally, they were put into a situation, a war situation, which they were unprepared for. And not only were they unprepared for it, but the civilian population of Chechnya was even more unprepared for it. No state of emergency had been called in 1994. It wasn't called in 1999 either. So many of those who remained in Grozny at this particular time were surprised that the bombing was taking place so quickly and so rapidly. But the ironical thing that happened was that those Chechens who did get out did actually go to the countryside and stay with their relatives. Unfortunately, for those who stayed inside Grozny, the end wasn't, the result wasn't quite as good. I mean, fundamentally, there were many Russians who were still living in Grozny, who had no relatives, especially elderly Russians, who had no relatives in the countryside that they could actually go to. Or they didn't have the financial means or the physical means to actually leave the city to get out. So what you found in 1994 was not only were Russians bombing Chechen civilians, but they were also, unfortunately, bombing a city which had Russian civilians inside as well. That war, I think, as you pointed out, David, there was a lot more. There were a lot more demonstrations in Moscow. I was living in Moscow at that time, and fundamentally, people felt very, very uneasy and very, very concerned about what this war would mean for the future of democracy in Russia. This was only 3 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there was a lot of public protest. There was a very renowned march from Moscow to Grozny. So these kind of fundamental demonstrations were taking place, which showed that civil society was burgeoning, and also people were concerned about maintaining all the things that they had so achieved in such a fragile way from 1991. Mm. So this first war, I think what we can see in it, though, is some of the strategies that would be used in the later Second War were fundamentally worked out here. One is the filtration points. These filtration points are like temporary detention units. They could be anywhere in Chechnya, in a field, in a barn, in a reservoir, in which men were detained and tortured. In this particular instance, the Russians used a lot of dogs and, electric shocks and so forth on Chechen men. But the civil society in Chechnya wasn't as frightened as they were later about actually surrounding these filtration points and demanding the release of those men who had been detained. So it looked as though Russia was going to win this war, if you like to put it that way, but fundamentally Shamil Basayev, Aslan Maskhadov, who were head of the Chechen resistance movement, led a very, very successful campaign in Grozny, and it looked as though Russia was under threat of losing. And this was another remarkable thing, that this was such an asymmetrical war that people felt that fundamentally, you know, Russia was bound to win. But it looked as though the morale, the fact that the Chechens knew their own areas, then they knew how to operate in the mountains and in Grozny. So they fundamentally were pushed to the negotiating table and they signed the Hasavyurt peace agreement. Now, that agreement essentially decided that the question of Chechen independence would be delayed for 5 years. So it was signed in 1996. And then they said that they would return to the question of independence in 2001. And so this was a very problematic, as you can imagine, to leave such an important question open for a period of 5 years. What happened was that the Chechens interpreted this as their victory, that fundamentally they had achieved their independence. And Aslan Mashat, they conducted elections. Aslan Mashatov was elected president, and he was recognized as president of the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria. Now, while all these while this situation was being played out, fundamentally, Mashatov had problems in the interim period in maintaining a stable situation in Chechnya. And the reasons for that are numerous, but I think that the first one is that he was concerned about the more radical contingent within his own constituency. And that means Shamil Basayev, it means Yandabiev. All these particular members of the Chechen resistance who took a more radical stance. And he realized as a moderate that he needed to control these people. And how he was going to do it was very, very difficult. He tried to incorporate them into his own government without a great deal of success. And so what you see in 1996 to 1998 is the division, right? The division between the radicals and the moderates within the Chechen resistance begins to be played out. And this becomes very decisive and catastrophic for the Chechen population living there. Now, that's one reason. The second is that the Chechen Republic is really fundamentally ignored by Russia, ignored by the international community as it stands, and by that I mean in terms of humanitarian aid, in terms of development aid, in terms of trying to open up this republic to a broader community. And this is really problematic. I mean, unlike the former Yugoslavia or unlike Kosovo, they're just not getting the type of aid and assistance that they needed to rebuild a country that was poor even before the war, but fundamentally completely broken down as a result of that war.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Emma Gilligan. She is assistant professor of Russian history and human rights at the University of Connecticut and is the author of the book Terror in Chechnya, Russia, and the Tragedy of Civilians in War. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, going into the second Chechen War here now, we have a change of government. At this point now, Vladimir Putin is now president.
Mm-hmm.
We have, if not a change in tactics, perhaps an escalation of some of the same tactics they used in the first war. But I think also important, maybe most important, is the way that the Russian government talked about what this war was about.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's right, David. The whole situation had fundamentally changed, and as I said before, that the divisions within the Chechen resistance movement were very problematic, and this division was to provide the pretext for the Second Chechen War by the Russian government. Now, there is some suspicion that already by March 1999, that the Russian security services had decided that they were going to go back into Chechnya because they were concerned, and I think with legitimate reason, about what was taking place on the ground. They were concerned that members that were linked, we don't know how well, to Al-Qaeda were actually in Chechnya and had actually set up one training camp inside Chechnya, and that what was going to happen as a result of that was uncertain, but it was certainly something that they needed to be concerned about. Now, with that in mind, Mashatov was finding it hard to control the situation. So what happened was that the radical wing led an incursion into neighboring Dagestan, and they did so because under the influence of Wahhabi extremists, they decided that they wanted to form a caliphate from the Black to the Caspian Seas. So this was what generated the Second War. Also, following that, there were Moscow apartment bombings, which many people perhaps remember, a series of bombings in Moscow in which many hundreds of people were killed. Now, that's never been proven that those bombings were the result of the Chechen resistance movement, and they never claimed responsibility for them. And in fact, there is some speculation that indeed the Russian FSB or the Federal Security Bureau may have had some hand in that, although none of that has come to light. So the Russian government did have legitimate reason to be concerned. The question is, did it have legitimate reason to send 120,000 troops back into Chechnya? And they did this after pushing Chechen radicals back into Chechnya out of Dagestan, and they pushed them back further beyond south of the Terek River into the Caucasus Mountains again, and Russian troops head back into the region. Now, the way you asked me about the way that this is framed, and I guess it's important to remember that many army generals who were disappointed about the results of the First Chechen War, let's put it that way, they actually were part of this Second Chechen War, and one has to admit that they felt as though they wanted to go back in and win this war because they felt that they had lost the first one. But the way in which this war was framed was something very different. It wasn't framed as a nationalist desire for self-determination. It was framed as a war against international terrorists. So even the Minister of Justice was saying, this is not a war against Chechens, this is a war against international terrorists. So that is the new framing of the war itself. Unfortunately, that idea of international terrorists did extend to, I would argue, a collective punishment campaign against Chechen civilians as well as members of the Chechen resistance.
Well, and this, I think, leads to a question. It gets to this question of why it is that the rest of the world seemed to pay so little attention to this, or at least had so little to say about what Russia did during this time in Chechnya. And I think a lot of people argue that they have to think about 2001,
mm-hmm.
and about the interest of the United States and its close allies to have the Russians on board with whatever it was that we were deciding we were going to do to deal with what we called our terrorist problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation that we got into with the Russians was that they said to us, you know, you've got your terrorist problem, we've got our terrorist problem. We'll help you with yours, or at least we won't get in the way. But what the Russians clearly were expecting is that they would also be left alone to deal with what they considered their quote-unquote terrorist problem in whatever way they felt appropriate.
Mm.
And that perhaps some governments like the United States and others felt that their ability to criticize Russia for its conduct in Chechnya was hobbled by the interest in having the Russians be cooperative when it came to going after Al-Qaeda or other sorts of terrorist groups that were the concern of the West.
Yeah, I think that you're quite right. I mean, there is an interim period between 1999 and 2001 before the September 11th, and there are obviously people who come out in the State Department and do make some very significant statements about and concerns about what the implications of this campaign in Chechnya is going to be for the civilian population. And certainly, if suddenly, within 2 months, between September 1999 or several months to January 2000, you have, you know, over 300,000 refugees go over the border into Ingushetia and into Dagestan, there's certainly a problem of the aerial bombardment and the cluster bombs that were used in this second campaign were, you know, of a greater scale scale than they had been used in the first campaign. So the international governments, the United States, does come out. It does meet Aslan Maskhadov, who was the foreign minister for the Chechen resistance, who sought political asylum in Washington. They do meet with him to discuss what the situation is like. Europe is something different. Europe comes out very strongly, and I have to say that the Council of Europe in particular remains on the case of Chechnya for years to come, well after 2001. But there's no doubt that, as you say, that after 2001, that and as information about Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, as the policy of rendition became increasingly disclosed, that it became very, very difficult for the United States to make claims or criticize the Russian government for conducting torture or disappearing either Chechen civilians or combatants during the war itself. So what happens, in a sense, is an extreme censorship, you know, of exactly what's taking place on the ground for these people. And there's no doubt that the United States is also wanting information from Russia on its own, having access to its own intelligence and to share that intelligence. Now, in Europe, while the Council of Europe comes out and is very, very strongly critical and really sets up the first international monitoring group down in Chechnya, the Council of Ministers, or the European Union, are very, very cautious about what they say about Russia. No one is prepared, not one state within the European Union, is prepared to take Russia to the European Court of Human Rights. Any member of the European Union can bring a case towards Russia because of human rights violations, and that case should be come up before the European Court of Human Rights. But not one member of the European Union is actually prepared to do that. Now, there are many reasons for that, but one is that I think that Europe grew increasingly concerned, one, about terrorism, but two, about also its access to Russia's natural resources, most predominantly gas. And I think that Germany, if anybody, was mostly concerned about that. And if you remember that after 2001, that many within the German administration came out and said, well, we have to change our perspective on Chechnya in relationship to Russia. And this was quite a startling statement for everybody involved. So I think that that was the general climate that emerged after 2001. And that's been very detrimental to the exposure of these crimes, and also I think trying to get funding to actually document and expose the breadth of them.
I want to have you talk a little bit more about that. The book does indeed go into detail about the tactics that the Russians used, bombings and the sweeps and disappearances and torture, and in an effort perhaps not only to deal with individuals that would be engaged in violence or would be strongly committed to separatism or independence, but it sounds as if there was a deliberate effort to destroy Chechenian society. And your argument is that all of these things constitute war crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that my argument extends even beyond that, David. I think that it extends to, and one of the central core of it is trying to, if we were to think about the crimes committed through the dimensions of international law, then I think we can certainly make a claim for crimes against humanity as well as war crimes. The issue there is that crimes against humanity is a particular category of war crimes that relates only to civilians. And unlike genocide, with crimes against humanity, you don't have to prove that there was intent to kill or in whole or in part a political, racial, national, ethnic, or cultural or religious group. But what Crimes Against Humanity does is it proves that you need to prove that the violations were systematic and that they were widespread and that they targeted the civilian population. Mm. Now, unlike war crimes, Crimes Against Humanity actually proves that you were targeting these people on the basis of their race or their ethnicity or their religious or cultural background, right? And that really part of your intent was to subjugate that particular population and to conduct a collective punishment against them. And I think that the Russian forces did have that in mind when they went into Chechnya and the ways in which they conducted their military campaign. Now, that's not to say that all felt equally about that. There is a distinction between contract soldiers and soldiers who work for the special forces who were particularly brutal and probably responsible for most of the disappearances and for the sweep operations that take place inside villages. Then there are many conscript soldiers, those 18, 19, 20-year-old soldiers who really did, in some cases, do all they could to actually protect the civilian population. So often during a sweep operation, it was the responsibility of the conscript soldier to surround the village. So often what they did before the special forces came in, sometimes what they did was that conscript soldiers came into the village and told people to either leave the village, to get underground, to hide their young men in particular, or men of any age between 14 and 65, because the special forces were coming in the following day. So, you know, it wasn't a blanket policy, but certainly the special forces were intent on humiliating and punishing the civilian population. And I think to create an atmosphere of fear, and that atmosphere of fear, I think they hoped would then stop young men or women, black widows as they're called, from joining the resistance.
Let us also come to, because I think that there are some people who will say when they hear discussion of war crimes or crimes against humanity committed by Russia in Chechnya, they will also say that Chechens committed war crimes,
sure,
were engaged in terrorism.
Yeah.
This is something that also that you deal with and certainly you would not excuse. But perhaps the argument that you make, at the very least, there was a very significant difference in the scale between the crimes committed by the two sides.
That's right, yeah. And I don't think at all that you can dismiss the Chechen crimes because they're very extensive, they're very brutal, and they're very barbaric. And the two most noted instances of that are, as people might remember, at the Dubrovka Theatre in 2002 in Moscow, when members of the Chechen resistance actually took the theatre hostage, which was full of people, mm-hmm, and full of actors, and kept them there for a couple of days. People were shot during that campaign. And, you know, this was the first indication during this Dubrovka hostage-taking campaign when it was obvious that the Chechen radical resistance was under some influence by extremist Wahhabis. Because what you had all of a sudden is women, black widows as they're called, Chechen women, dressed and covered completely in black. They had dynamite waist belts. They also came in and they put Arab signs up, written in Arabic, you know, on top of the theater. So there were some sense that the field or that the influence that the Chechen resistance had come under was more extensive and it was international. Now, this particular campaign was stopped by the Russian Federal Security Bureau, who, as you may remember, actually fed in a particular type of gas, a sleeping gas, into the theater itself. Unfortunately, the emergency wing wasn't really warned beforehand what type of gas this was and what needed to be done, and so many people were pulled out with their heads rolling back, and many of them died as a result of that. So this campaign, then followed by the horrific Beslan hostage-taking, where people might remember the poor school children who were gathering together for school on the first day in September, who actually were then taken hostage in 2004 by, again, radicals within the Chechen resistance. Now, this campaign, too, was particularly brutal. One, obviously, you have school-age children. You had mothers there with young babies. And unlike Dubrovka, they didn't give them food, they didn't give them water, and they sat them together in this basketball ring in which they put, detonators from one side of one basketball hoop to the other. So the climate there was, you know, horrific. So I think certainly by Beslan, if there had been any sense of sympathy for the Chechen resistance, it had completely eradicated by then. But you need to be aware that increasingly the divide within that resistance, Masharov, those members of the moderate resistance actually came out and said, you know, we do not condone anything, any of these hostage-taking that is going on, and this is not within our domain. This is within the domain of Shamil Basadov, Basayev, for example, and those who are more concerned about getting Russians to completely withdraw from Chechnya itself. So there's no excuse for that, and also one has to highlight that POWs or prisoners of war captured by Chechens, Russian ones, have also been tortured and also been subject to some very brutal behavior.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Emma Gilligan. She is assistant professor of Russian history and human rights at the University of Connecticut. And we're talking about the Chechen wars, the subject of her book, Terror in Chechnya, Russia and the Tragedy of Civilians in War. It's published by the Princeton University Press. We have about 7-8 minutes left. We have a caller we'll get to, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Effingham, line one. Hello.
Hello. Thanks, David. It's a great subject matter, the continuity and the playing out over and over again of the subject matter today is as old as colonialism. And whenever people encroach upon another people, then all the things that you've been talking about occur. And then after Russia declared, you know, the Gorbachev and Perestroika and all that nonsense, I'm sure that it gave people the idea that they were going to be free, free of oppression and all the other things that go along with colonialist activity. Mm-hmm. And how long will it take humanity to learn that that stuff has got to stop? And the sacrifice that humans have been subjected to and continue to do so, you know, the last 30 years have been, it's not a matter of who, it's where, and how many of these things go on at the same time. And somehow that's got to be addressed, and humanity has got to have some relief from the things that to learn to leave each other alone. If you don't agree with someone's religion, then be that as it may. But it's, again, to religion itself is a colonial enterprise and it has been troubling humans for thousands of years. Well, that's my opinion, and however you want to address that, why, thank you very much for taking my call.
Well, thank you very much for calling. I agree with you, and I don't necessarily have the solution, apart from that it would be wonderful to see in international law some kind of regulation of self-determination claims. Now, if there are many, many problems in human rights law and humanitarian law, but one great absence that we have is that there is no law on self-determination. So how do you regulate a self-determination claim? And are the two bodies who were actually involved, in this case Russia and Chechnya, shouldn't a third body perhaps come in, if possible at all, to regulate such a claim? So that is the first problem. Now, the second one, obviously, is our desire often to deal with conflicts through violence rather than dealing with them through negotiations. And I think in this particular case, that the failure to negotiate, especially during the Second War, was highly problematic. President Putin said that he would not negotiate with Aslan Maskhadov, the president of Chechnya, because that was like asking the American government to negotiate with Al-Qaeda. Now, those comparisons are a little bit steep. The situation was entirely different. So that would be my two responses to that, and I only hope that there are international lawyers out there thinking about precisely how we can try and regulate self-determination claims, because they are highly problematic.
I have a question here that's come in through the email of someone who is interested in knowing what role that Chechen organized crime might play in current politics in the Caucasus.
I think that's a good question. I mean, the degree to which Ramzan Kadyrov, who is the current president of Chechnya, to what degree he's involved in corrupt practices, I don't know. The degree to which he's involved in through his own presidential forces, through the Kadyrovtsy, of actually incarcerating and torturing people, is well known. Now, there are certainly indications in Moscow and in Chechnya that there are corrupt members of the business sector in both sections, but I'm not quite sure how that's playing out in Chechnya today. I mean, it certainly would have some influence. Now, how that's affecting the oil industry, for example, in Chechnya is another question that needs to be debated. Many would say to you that the Second Chechen War was really a result of economics, that many people wanted to secure the oil that's in Chechnya, which is, to be honest, rather negligible in terms of what the rest of Russia produces. But still, it's significant enough for those who have financial interests to want to keep a hold of it.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I guess I'd like to come around it to the point where you conclude the book. And you're hoping clearly to make sure people are aware of what took place in Chechnya, making some criticisms of how the international community responded or failed to respond. And then, as you put it here, the ways that it might be possible to bring Chechnya back onto the public's moral radar. I like that phrase very much. How might that be, and again, I'm afraid I only have a couple of minutes, but how might that be accomplished?
Two ways, David, I think. The first is to systematically collate information. There are many great NGOs working in Russia who are doing this, but to bring it to a place where it's safe, where it can be researched, to interview as many people as possible, to do a large documentation and witness testimony collation. The second way, I think, is to have an international commission of inquiry like was undertaken for the former Kosovo crisis, and to have major lawyers, human rights activists and scholars come together to write a major report on what has happened and what needs to be done. The third thing is, I think, is a non-government tribunal. Given that war crimes tribunals often take place only when crises have ended or when the UN can go into a country and set up its own tribunal. In the case of Russia, that's not possible. So the third sector really needs to come to the fore and to try and organize some kind of at least public hearing.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess the big question would be, given the fact that I think the governments of Western Europe and the United States are interested in trying to maintain positive relations with Russia, and this is something certainly the Russians would not be happy about. Who in the world would be in a position to push for such a thing?
Well, I think that there are plenty of people that can push for it, but they just have to come out of the third sector. I think they have to be, lawyers who are interested in this question, who are representing people at the European Court of Human Rights. It needs to be scholars. It needs to be human rights activists who don't necessarily live in Russia, because, as you know, with the recent deaths of Esther Mirova, Markovlev and Politkovskaya, it's not really a safe undertaking at this particular moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we'll have to leave it at that with our thanks to our guest, Emma Gilligan. She is Assistant Professor of Russian History and Human Rights at the University of Connecticut, and she's the author of the book Terror in Chechnya, the subtitle Russia and the Tragedy of Civilians in War. It's published by the Princeton University Press. I'm sure you can find it in a bookstore or the library if you're interested in reading on the subject. And Professor Gilligan, we want to say to you, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, David, thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.